Well, good morning, everyone. So thank you for getting up early to come to my talk today. I barely made it out of bed myself. So I hope we have a good time. It's a really exciting time in the history of networking when it comes to visibility into the internet. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today, is new advances, new techniques that are coming out of the evolution of technology that can enable all of us, each and every one of us, you and I, to individually get visibility into what is happening throughout the internet like has never really been possible before. Now, I am just a little bit about myself. I'm a professor at the University of Michigan, where I work in security and privacy, with an emphasis on problems that affect the real world. I am, however, an armchair professor, and it's always a really great privilege to be speaking to people who are actually in the world doing things instead of up in the ivory tower somewhere sitting on our asses. So please bear with me if anything is not clear, is not at the level of detail you'd like. If you'd like more detail, please do ask in Q&A or even interrupt me, as is the style in talks where I come from. So just before I begin, what I'm going to be talking about today is not only my work, but is collaborative work with a great many people who I will list up here so you can go and take a look at our papers. They're all available on my website. I've taken an open access pledge, so everything that I write is available for free. In particular, I need to acknowledge my student, Zakir Durumaric. Most of this work I'm going to be talking about today is going to form a large part of his dissertation, and he's been working on this extremely well over the past couple of years. So, the internet, right? This is where we live. And it looks something like this, according to the kinds of maps that that people have been making since the late 90s. This is a visualization of routing interconnections on the internet, sort of the topology of the network. But just seeing the shape of the land in a picture like this doesn't really tell us that much about what's there. Are there trees? Are there people? Are there flowers? Are there mountains? We need to know a different level of detail and a different kind of information in order to make sense of the devices, the information that makes up the internet. And one place we can get some insight into that is from search engines like Google. But Google indexes the web. And so when their crawlers are navigating the internet, they're concentrating on websites that are making up this interconnected graph of links that is where most of us spend most of our time. But if you think about the internet in a different way, in terms of what's plugged into it, what makes up the public address space, you end up getting a very, very different picture from what you see in a search engine. And what I'm going to be talking about today is methodology, techniques that we can use to get that kind of view of the internet, a kind of view of the internet that is about the devices, the computers, the embedded systems that are plugged into it. So internet-wide scanning, the topic of my talk, I just find this so exciting. I've been fascinated by the idea that it's possible, it's tractable, to connect to every computer on the internet and have a conversation with it for many, many years. And some of the first inspiration for me came out of this project pioneered by the EFF called the SSL Observatory. What the SSL Observatory did is they had a small cluster of machines that they used over a period of months to try to make a connection to every HTTPS website. And they did this not with a list of websites, but by exhaustively enumerating the IP address space. So if you think about it, there are IPv4 addresses are 32 bits. There are about 4 billion of them. Maybe, I don't know, 15-20% of them are not publicly routable. So you have a substantial fraction of 4 billion addresses. That seems like a lot on one hand, but on the other hand, networks and computers have gotten so much faster in recent years that suddenly just making a TCP connection to all of these machines is something that you can do, that we can write programs to do. It's not easy, but it's tractable. Further inspiration came about a year ago from this research from the Karna botnet. The Karna botnet was an experiment done by some anonymous people, who may or may not be here, who discovered that if they did this kind of internet-wide probing, if they probed embedded systems, they found many, many systems that would allow them root access with just a short list of default passwords. That's my understanding. And using this technique, they compromised about 420,000 boxes, things like, I presume that they were of the form of home routers and so forth, many of them. And they used these boxes to do probing of the rest of the internet on a variety of really interesting ports. So this is a map of the hosts that were compromised as part of the Karna botnet to do this study. So they got a huge volume of really, really interesting data from that, as the EFF did when they were probing HTTPS. But what I think is true about both of these studies is that they're both really impressive in terms of what they got, but also were a tremendous amount of effort, of time, for the people who did them. I don't think every one of us is able or willing to create a botnet, at least I hope not, for purposes of internet-wide research. So there have been a couple of other studies I should mention too, and these are, I think, at least from my perspective, these are some of the more interesting works that have come out over the past 5 years. The first one on this list, Census and Survey of the Visible Internet in 2008, was a study of what addresses were connected and routable in the IPv4 space, not a security study. But it claimed to be the first exhaustive survey of IP addresses plugged into the internet for 20 years. So since the time the internet was very small until just 5 years ago, has been a dark age. If you think about the evolution of the universe, we have these periods when we have more visibility and less visibility. Well, that was a period of very little visibility. Since then, we've had studies like the ESSL Observatory, like one I was involved in 2 years ago that I'll tell you a little bit about, where we were able to compromise a substantial fraction of the private keys used for internet cryptography using internet-wide scanning techniques. And then the Karna botnet just last year, all exciting work. But what unifies these is they take so much effort to do. So we're talking about thousands of CPU hours, months of waiting. The first three studies on this list all involved the use of off-the-shelf network probing tools, things like Nmap. And Nmap, although a wonderful security tool, something I use all the time, I have great admiration for Fyodor and his work, Nmap is not a tool that's designed or optimized for internet-wide scanning. And that turns out to be a large part of the problem. So in each of these cases, either tremendous effort by the researchers, tremendous time, or a large number of hosts was required. So the problem, from my perspective, is we've been using tools like this to try to get visibility into the devices plugged into the internet, where we really want something like this. We want something that's designed, optimized for the purpose of internet-wide scanning. So in my research group last year, we asked, well, what if this kind of work didn't require heroic effort for researchers? What if we could democratize internet-wide measurement? What if we could do a scan like the SSL Observatory that EFF did every day? How much more detail, what new things could we learn with that degree of visibility? And in particular, what kinds of optimization could we do if we wrote a scanner from scratch to do internet-wide measurement? So to answer these questions, we went and built that scanner, and we built a tool called Zmap that you can download right now. ZMAP is an open source tool that will allow you to do a horizontal scan of the whole internet, so looking at one port across every routable IPv4 address from just one machine in about 45 minutes if you have enough upstream bandwidth, and to be able to get to see almost everything that you would see by using more precise and thorough methods. So this is something we call shotgun scanning, just in the same way as shotgun DNA sequencing. Rapid, relatively dirty, but very effective technique that gives you that drastically reduces the cost of doing scanning. So if you have, say, a gigabit upstream, like you could get if you can plug into a wall here, I hear that they have much more bandwidth available, but my understanding, and maybe someone involved in the network here can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the distribution layer that takes it down to the ports you can get access to is only running at a gigabit, so you're going to get performance like this instead of 10 gigabit or more performance. But you can complete a scan in less than an hour and contact every routable IP address. Now, it really is as simple as this. I'm going to give you a demo in just a second. However, I recommend not doing it from the Wi-Fi, at least not during my talk, because that might interfere with the ability to demonstrate what I have to show you. So let me quickly start something up here so that it finishes before our hour is up. So I'm going to do this in a VM. And I'm going to try to make it a little bit bigger. So what I'm going to do, let me show you ZMAP in operation. So if this is still communicating with the internet, come on TCP. Let's try that again. Boo, boo, boo. Well, maybe the internet is no longer working. Internet, are you still there? Someone broke the internet. If anyone in this room is running an internet-wide scan from the Wi-Fi, can you please, can you please pause it? All right, so I should be able to get a few packets through here. This is one of those cases where it works before the audience is all on their laptops, but as soon as you start speaking and people get bored and start reading email, it stops. Okay, this is not being terribly responsive. Okay, well, maybe I can run something locally. Let me see if this works, and I haven't tested this from the local machine yet. Not working from the local machine either, because all the packets are dropping, right, for the same reason that it doesn't work remotely. All right, well, if I was able to give you a demo, which I promise I will start a demo as soon as this internet comes back, I could demonstrate a couple of things. One thing is ZMAP is good for some fun tricks. Let's say you want to find some open proxies, some machines that are listening on 8080. Well, you can type a command ZMAP-P8080-N, say you want 1,000 addresses that are listening on that port. And in substantially less than a second, you're going to get back a list of 1,000 IP addresses that are responsive on that port. A large fraction of them are going to be open proxies. You want to find some random web servers, the same thing. So that's if you want to just do a small sample. If you want to scan everything, you could type a command like the one I was planning to run. Still not working. Like the one I was planning to run, which would be something like this. So what I'm going to do in the hour after this talk, assuming that I can get on the internet and talk to a machine at Michigan that has a fast uplink, is I'm going to do a syn scan on port 0x30C3. So let's just let the world know that we're here today by making a connection to every public IP address on that port. So if you, on your machine, anywhere in the world, over the hour after the talk, want to, say, run TCP dump and look for incoming SYN packets on that port, I think you'll get one from us in the Michigan subnet is 141.212/16. So look for an incoming packet from there. If you get one, you'll know it's part of the scan. And I'd appreciate if people who are looking for that let me know whether they've gotten one or not, because that'll give us a nice informal experiment, some scientific purpose, an informal experiment about reachability and coverage for the scanner. So I'm sorry, I was planning to do this live during the talk. It'll only take 45 minutes, but it involves sending about 100 bytes to another machine in order to get it started, which we don't have the ability to do, apparently. All right, so I am not here, however, just to push ZMAP, and there are other tools that have been developed in about the same time frame that I'd like to also lend my endorsement to. In particular, there's a very excellent tool called MassScan that's been developed by Robert Graham, which is aimed at very similar purposes. And these are parallel efforts. They're both open source, actively developed open source projects. They're both high performance scanning tools. You should try both of them and see which one better suits your needs. I don't think either of us knew about the other effort when we were building our tools, but now you have two very good options to choose from. MassScan, if you are willing to install some commercial drivers, can use this thing called PFRing DNA to drive a 10 gig NIC at line speed. ZMAP is entirely in user space right now. We can drive from user space a 1 gig NIC at line speed. We can drive a 10 gig NIC at some multiple of 1 gig. We're not quite up to 10 gig yet, but we're planning to port over PFRing DNA support very soon, so you'll be able to use your whole very fat pipe. And we do have a 10 gig uplink waiting. All right, so let me talk a little bit about how high-speed scanning works, some of the engineering tricks we've used to do it. I'll give you a little bit of evidence that this actually works, because I, too, was skeptical when I until we ran the experiments. And then I'll talk about some fun things that you that we all can do with it. So in developing ZMAP, we realized we needed to do a bunch of things differently from existing general-purpose scanners like NMAP. In order to try to get really high bandwidth performance out of it. So one thing we decided to do was attempt to eliminate as much state as possible from each of the connections that connection attempts we're trying to make. So the way NMAP works, it maintains some state to track each connection it's trying to open. It has timeouts for each of those connections. It uses batching in order to do rate limiting and avoid oversaturating the network. We can't do any of these things really efficiently, because in order to scan at even 1 gigabit per second line speed, you have to send about 1.5 million packets per second. So managing state for that many connections is not something that we felt was a good idea. So what we're able to do, the way we architected ZMAP, we have separate processes for separate threads for sending and receiving packets. The sending processes are sending in, say, a SYN scan. They're sending SYNs as quickly as they possibly can. They're not communicating with the receiving threads. The receiving threads are looking at what's coming in processing it asynchronously from the sending. Another thing we did differently was the way that we are tracking which hosts are responding. Let me get to that in one more slide. In order to avoid flooding the network, and this is a really important thing too, because if we send, if we overwhelm distant networks, they're just going to drop our probes and we're not going to get accurate data. One past approach to this has been just to severely limit the rate at which you scan, but the thing that makes more sense is to do randomization, to use basically get statistical guarantees that you're unlikely to overwhelm any distant network with traffic, even if you're scanning as fast as your upstream will allow. And I'll talk about how we do that too. Finally, a lot of the credit for the ability to do scanning at gigabit, 10 gigabit Ethernet line speed ought to go to the operating systems and to the underlying architecture, because there have been vast improvements to things like the Linux kernel, to the way processor to network card communication happens in Intel architecture that underlie all of this. But still, there are inefficiencies. There are things we don't need in the kernel, like the TCP stack. So one thing we do is we write out Ethernet frames directly. We're skipping everything that the kernel is trying to do to help us. This lets us just change the parts of the packet that need to be changed for each additional probe we're sending. It helps us get much, much better efficiency. So a couple of the more interesting challenges we face. One is how to do addressing. So the challenge here is that we want to be able to address, we want to enumerate the IPv4 address space in a random order every time we scan, so that we're not overwhelming distant networks, so that if we want to scan less than the full internet, we can get a statistically relevant sample, and so forth. The way we chose to do this is and we want to do this without storing a lot of state. We don't want to have to make up this list of all the addresses in advance and then use it, because that's going to be for 4 billion addresses. This is going to be a multiple gigabyte list. So what we do instead is we use this trick from the world of math. No, this trick that the crypto people would think is trivial. Where we iterate over a multiplicative group of integers modulo p for some p that's about the size of the address space. So what this allows us to do is, with just a negligible amount, a constant amount of space, that is the primitive root that defines this multiplicative group, our current location within the group, and the starting address, we can enumerate the IP address space in random order. And if we want a different permutation, a different ordering, we can just vary the generator that we're using to define this. So with just a very, very small amount of state, we can get a nice random ordering of the IP address space. Another thing that we do is the way we validate responses in an almost totally stateless way is by taking some secret and basically encoding it in fields of the outgoing probe, such that we can recognize whether a packet coming back in is a result of our scanning, or is it background traffic, is it just someone trying to attack us, whatever. We need to differentiate responses that are a result of our probes from any other traffic we might be receiving, including sort of the noise that happens after we run a big internet-wide scan. Some people are going to scan us back. Some people are going to be trying to DOS us. Some people will be connecting just to see why they got a probe packet and so forth. So the technique we use for this is very much like the idea behind SYN cookies. So the idea is, if we were to look into the headers for, say, a SYN probe here, there are a bunch of fields that we can use to encode distinguishable data. So based on some per-scan random secret, we encode bits into the sending IP address, if we have a range of addresses to send from, into the sending port, and into the initial sequence number. And so when a response comes back, the receiving IP address, receiver port, and acknowledgement number are going to reflect that information we put into those fields. So we can then look at them and get and learn with high statistical certainty whether this probe was a response to whether this response was coming back as a result of a probe we sent or not. All right. Finally, the overall architecture of the tool is optimized for extendability, for the ability to build new things on top of it as easily as possible. So we try to do the hard work in the main body of the tool. This is all written in C. We provide some probe modules and response interpretation modules that you can take and modify and build on to do all sorts of different scans. So we ship with things for doing SYN scans. We ship with things for doing certain kinds of UDP probing. If you want to extend this to do other kinds of probing, it's a simple matter of modifying these modules. We also try to, because we wanted to use this for research, we tried to make the output system very flexible so that we could take data coming back from the scanner, throw it into a database, throw it into Redis. We have a variety of output handling modules that you can use for different purposes. We also have, because initially what this is providing is just basically a port scan, you probably want to do more. You probably want to find out hosts that have that port open and make a real TCP connection to them. So to allow you to do that, there are a couple of ways to plug this together. We ship the tool with a banner grab program that can very efficiently make many thousands of TCP connections in parallel to download, say, the root of a website or the banner from a Telnet server, put that in a database for you. Or if that's going to be too much work to use a separate program for that, you can integrate that into your output handler in ZMAP. And we do provide a kernel module if you want to do this with the TCP connection you've half opened with that initial SYN scan. So we have a TCP a kernel module that will complete the handshake and give you back a socket. That's not something that Linux can do out of the box. All right, so really quickly, if this is how it works, does this actually work? So you might think that if you're doing a scan, even at a gigabit, packets are going to get dropped. There's no way that if you're doing what I'm proposing, which is just send one SYN packet to everyone and see what comes back, there's no way you're going to get very good coverage. Surely enough will be dropped that you have to send multiple SYNs. You have to retry, right? Well, the data says differently. So this is one experiment we ran where we tried doing scanning. This is, I think, on port 443. Multiple trials of scanning for, I think this is for 1% samples of the IP address space at different rates of outgoing probe packets. And what we're really looking for here is we're looking for how fast is too fast. We're looking for the point when we start seeing fewer responsive hosts because we're overwhelming the network. Well, in the experiments we did up to, this is with a gigabit uplink, up to a gigabit, we were not able on our network to observe any meaningful drop-off. So there's some fluctuation based on other things I'll talk about in a second. But basically, we cannot find the place where we start seeing drop-off because we're overwhelming the network. So based on this, we conclude that that gigabit scanning, at least up to a gigabit, is not enough to overwhelm upstream. However, your mileage may vary. This depends a lot on what the network topology around you looks like. We happen to have a very, very well-provisioned uplink that connects in Chicago to several different major backbone providers. Your mileage may vary if your network upstream is not well-provisioned. Part of the reason for that variation you see, though, is that the number of devices that are responsive on the internet varies quite a bit over the course of a day, over the course of a week, just as a result of people in aggregate turning things on and off is our main theory. You turn off your phone or your cable modem at night. We see a variation of about plus or minus 3% on a typical day. So this is based on doing continuous scans of a 1% sample of hosts on port 443 over a 24-hour period. And you can see that very lovely diurnal pattern. Another question is, even if we're not overwhelming the network, are we getting back responses from everything that should be responding, even though we're not sending more than one SYN packet? So one way we can see this is by trying to send multiple SYN packets to each address. And what we'd expect to see is that as we send more and more, eventually we reach some plateau, some rate, some number of SYN packets at which only a vanishingly small number of hosts will have lost them all. So basically, we're trying to reach ground truth here, some denominator against which to compare the numerator of how many results we've gotten. Well, what we do see, what we find indeed, is that there is a plateau. Really, it starts to level off at about 8 SYN probes per host. But the difference for fewer than that is actually quite small. You can see the scale on the left. So based on this, if we use this point, this plateau as a kind of ground truth, this is where we get at this number of about 97% to 98% of responsive hosts are going to be reached with just one SYN packet. All right, so it's a little bit unfair to compare scanners like ZMAP to NMAP, which was not designed for internet-wide scanning. But it's also a natural question to ask. So just really quickly, what do we get if we do this comparison? So let me give you some average times for using ZMAP and NMAP to scan a random sample of 1 million hosts. And this is all scanning the same sample. So with NMAPs, this is using NMAP's most aggressive default, insane is what it's called, plus a few flags that make it a bit faster than that. This is basically the configuration we used in the weak keys work I mentioned. So with this configuration, in NMAP's default configuration here, what I'm talking about, it tries to send up to 2 SYN packets per host. It waits for a timeout, then it sends another one. It will take about 116 days to probe the entire internet using that configuration. If we reduce NMAP to just sending one probe to just waiting one timeout interval, it will only take about 62 days. ZMAP, in its default configuration, in this experimental setup, would have taken about 1 hour, 10 minutes. We normally do faster, but these tests were done with a NIC that was not quite as good as the one we used for the 45-minute trials. ZMAP, in a maybe more comparable 2-probe configuration, would take about twice that, about 2 hours and 12 minutes. So quite a bit faster. In fact, this is about 1,300 times faster than NMAP's most aggressive default configuration. And I'm particularly proud of that because it's not often that you get 3 orders of magnitude through aggressive optimization. But when you do, oh man. Surprisingly, though, ZMAP also finds more hosts that are responsive than NMAP does. And we're really scratching our heads about that, because even with 2 probes, NMAP finds fewer responsive hosts than ZMAP does with 1 probe in these tests. So why is that? Well, that turns out to have to do with response time. So if we tried to do an experiment where we measure how long it takes for an ACK to come back after we send a SYN, so with a huge number of hosts, we can plot this as a cumulative fraction here, what we find is that if you just wait 250 milliseconds for an ACK to come back, you're only going to see about 85% of responsive hosts. If you wait 500 milliseconds, you're going to see about 98%. And it takes almost 8 seconds before things, a little more than 8 seconds actually, before things level out and you see the last responses trickling in. So things rattle around in the network for a while and then come back. Turns out that NMAP, because it has to maintain state for each connection, including a timeout, in its aggressive modes, has relatively short timeouts. Actually, the timeouts are something like 250 milliseconds and 500 milliseconds. So NMAP is going to just give up and move on after 200 milliseconds. ZMAP, because we're using this asynchronous design where we don't have any per-connection timeout, we'll just accept the response when it comes back eventually, if it comes back before the entire scan run terminates. That allows us to see these very long delayed responses. This is why we're able to get even higher coverage, even though we're using what's probably a much more aggressive means of doing an internet-wide scan. All right, so let me talk about a few applications, a few of the fun things that we've done. So let me start with a really fun one. So one thing that you can use internet-wide scanning for is finding things that are are vulnerable, and at really, really big scale, at internet-wide scale. So this is important from a white hat perspective because we want to know the impact of a problem that's been announced, or maybe we want to know before we do disclosure, before we go public with a vulnerability, how big the impact is going to be. Maybe this will help make a case to the manufacturer of whatever technology it is that they need to get their patch out now. In any case, we experimented with this a few times. The first time had to do with these vulnerabilities in UPnP that H.D. Moore announced about a year ago, where several common UPnP implementations had just terrible exploitable problems that were used in many millions of devices and could give a remote attacker root in just a single UDP packet. Well, it took less than 6 hours for one of my PhD students to code, using ZMAP, a scanner that would perform a UPnP discovery probe across all of the internet, and also to run the probe. So, and by doing that, we found about 16 million responsive UPnP devices. About 3 million of them would have been vulnerable. Still, even when we did this, this was maybe a month after the vulnerabilities were disclosed, we're still vulnerable to the vulnerabilities that that H.D. Moore went public with. So in the same amount of time, if you had an exploit ready, you could have exploited all of these machines. So it's both really valuable from a defensive standpoint and really, really scary from a vulnerability standpoint that this kind of very high-speed probing is possible. Of course, you always could have done this with a botnet, right? So in one sense, it doesn't make anything possible for the attacker that wasn't possible before. But this does democratize it. This puts the same technique, the same capability into all of our hands that previously maybe just a few of us who had botnets, a few of maybe you who had botnets, I don't have a botnet, had the ability to do. I should add, we did another study over the summer looking at IPMI devices. So IPMI is this remote management interface that's built into almost every server motherboard, where the motherboard actually has in addition to the CPU, it has an embedded ARM system on the motherboard that's on even when the server is powered off. And you can get into through a web interface to power cycle the server, monitor its health, get a remote KVM, you know, basically anything you could do if you had physical access to the box. Well, you'd think that they would have gotten IPMI security right, since this is protecting really valuable assets and giving you an incredible amount of power. It's basically a back door that comes with your server. But we looked into a leading IPMI manufacturer's implementation, and it was just riddled with vulnerabilities. I mean, I'm talking about root buffer overflow in the web interface's username and password fields. Anyway, using ZMAP, we were able to do a scan and figure out how many systems could be exploited immediately using this problem, and we were able to find, I forget the exact number, I don't have it on the slide, 50 to 100,000 servers that were plugged into public IP addresses, even though these are server-grade machines, that had this remotely exploitable IPMI. So there's sort of more depressing things you can do with this, enumerating hidden services. So if anyone here has built a service where you rely on the internet being large and your things being hard to find, you might want to rethink your threat model. We can easily uncover things using tools like ZMAP and high-speed scanning. So one experiment we did was looking for Tor bridges. And these are hidden Tor nodes that aren't publicly advertised that are used to let people in countries that practice censorship access Tor without that censor just blocking access to these IP addresses. And using a very simple application of ZMAP, we identified More than 86% of the Tor bridges that were live and allocated at the time in the Tor directory service. This is with a single scan, just looking at two ports. Now, this is not the state of the art in Tor. This is, luckily, Tor has already moved on. They've developed other techniques that are much more resistant to this attack, including OpsProxy, which randomizes the port it listens on, which makes it thousands of times harder to exhaustively enumerate everything, and also has maybe a more difficult to spot signature. However, this is something that other services ought to be worried about. Here's one more thing that's kind of fun we can do with this. So detecting service disruptions. So let's say there's a hurricane that happens, like what happened in my country last year. We had this this thing called Superstorm Sandy that hit the Northeast and flooded New Jersey. And Sandy was a terrific natural disaster. But one thing that we could do using internet-wide scanning is track exactly what was going off and when. So looking at power outages using internet-wide scanning. So what we did is my student Zakir and I just used ZMAP continuously to scan as fast as we could on, I think this was port 443 again, HTTPS, while the storm was going on. And we were able to look for locations, for areas in the network where there was a greater than normal decrease in the number of listening hosts. So places where the power went out and suddenly people's Netgear routers, for instance, were no longer exposing their web interface to the world. So by looking at the whole internet, we could spot evidence of this localized disaster. And we can do something like this on a continuous basis all the time if we want to spot for disruptions in critical infrastructure. All right, so let me tell you about one other thing that's a very interesting, to me anyway, security-related application of this. And this has to do with cryptography. And some of you have probably heard of this work. This is work that we did using basically the prototype to ZMAP in 2012, where we did a scan of everything that was using HTTPS and everything that was using SSH in order to collect the public keys that are used for crypto on the internet, for the most important protocols. So we found some very interesting things. Basically, we wanted to give to do a health check for the state of crypto online. And this was one of the easiest ways to get broad visibility into the global use of cryptography. One really interesting thing we found is that even though we found on the order of, for HTTPS, almost 13 million listening hosts, for SSH about 10 million hosts, the number of actual distinct, different public keys is much, much lower than that. So we have less than half the number of distinct public keys for HTTPS as we have hosts. This means there is a very large amount of duplication of keys, the same key used on multiple systems. Now, there's some legitimate reasons why hosts might share keys. Maybe these are all the different IP addresses that belong to Google. But there are also reasons that we detected, which are distinct security vulnerabilities. Things like default certificates that are in use across many, many different devices and hosts. Also evidence that many systems have problems with their random number generators, and that this resulted in distinct systems, completely distinct, opposite sides of the world, different owners, generating the same keys. Now, this is a problem, of course, because if you and I share the same public key, then we can each impersonate the other. And when you talk about this happening at global scale, with almost having only half the distinct number of keys as hosts, it's evidence of a really huge problem. But there is but there's another problem that we could spot using this kind of global data from scans, which is that some keys are not only duplicated in ways that would let you and I impersonate each other, but are duplicated in ways that would let me, with only the data we collected with scanning, actually figure out what your private key is. So one example of this has to do with RSA, where in RSA, and you should come to the crypto talk tonight if you want to learn much more detail about how these crypto systems actually work from real cryptographers. But in RSA, you have this modulus n that is a product of two large primes, p and q. Normally, we don't know any efficient way to go backwards, to get P and Q, your private key, from N, which is part of your public key. However, if your key wasn't quite properly generated, because, say, there was a problem with your random number generator, and you and I end up having different keys, but we share one of those two primes. Let's say we share P and have different Qs. Our public keys will look completely different. But if, say, we examine them together, we can very trivially factor both of them just by taking the greatest common divisor, which takes milliseconds. So we came up with a way, based on a technique by Dan Bernstein, that lets us take the GCD of all pairs of keys on the internet. And what this let us do is get the private keys to about 0.5% of all the TLS hosts, all the HTTPS hosts on the internet, because they have improperly generated keys of that form. Similarly with... Similarly with DSA, which is another public key algorithm that's used even more so for SSH than for TLS, we got more than 1% of everyone's, of all the host's private keys. And this is all based on visibility that we can get with internet-wide scanning. But there's a question of why are these systems vulnerable? Well, what are they, why are they vulnerable? Well, if we actually look at the certificates, say, that are served for HTTPS hosts with these vulnerabilities, here's what we see. These are not web servers. They're not normal web servers anyway. This is not Google or PayPal. Let's see, the systems say things like, oh, system generated, TP-Link technologies from TP-Link Soft. You can learn that this is some company that makes some kind of embedded system, gateway device, what's this? Xerox office printer at the University of Michigan CS department. And I swear I didn't pick this specifically for that. Turns out that almost all of these devices are different kinds of embedded systems. The Internet of Things is already here. This is the world we're living in. In fact, if you look at just random samples of IP addresses, almost everything you're going to be seeing is some kind of embedded or headless device. It's not a normal public server. So these are things like home routers, professional routers, server management devices, printers, etc. So in the end, in this weak key research, we identified devices from more than 40 different manufacturers, got in touch with those manufacturers to try to fix the problem. And we also traced the problem back to a fundamental problem in the Linux kernel. So this is one of the things that many of these devices shared, was that they were running Linux. Well, on Linux, where do you get random numbers for key generation? You probably get them in practice from devurandom. They say you should be using devrandom, but nobody does, trust me. So the way Linux generates random numbers is it looks at things like the time of boot, like keyboard and mouse movement, like disk access timing, and it mixes all of these together in something called the input entropy pool. Then periodically, when things read from devurandom, it mixes in the time the system turned on, and mixes in stuff from the input pool and gives you back some bits. Well, on a headless device, let's think about your Netgear router at home. You probably don't have a keyboard and mouse plugged into it. It doesn't have a traditional disk. It might not even have a clock. Oops. And there's another problem. which is that because of another security vulnerability that might happen if they didn't do this, data only gets copied from that input pool into the non-blocking pool after you've accumulated a certain amount of data, 192 bits in the kernels we looked at. That means dev-urandom can take a long time to warm up. And before it gets this much data, it may be entirely predictable. And this creates a period of time between when the system first boots and when it's warmed up, when it's a potential window of vulnerability. So in one test system, here is when dev-urandom warmed up and actually became randomized. Here's when OpenSSH seeded its internal random state. This is what we call a boot time entropy hall. And our hypothesis is that many of these vulnerable devices generated on first boot their private key during this entropy hall when they had not yet collected any form of randomness. So there's a fix in the kernel now as a result of all of this. It may or may not have rolled out to your distribution yet. Linux has now added other sources of entropy and is trying at least to make everyone's system distinct by rolling in the MAC address. If you want to learn more about this part of the work or to check your own keys online, we have a key check service at factorable.net that will tell you whether we have your private key. So just one more thing I want to tell you about, which is more we learned about HTTPS. We have another paper about this, actually looking at the ecosystem of surrounding HTTPS. So we all know there are too many certificate authorities that aren't secure or trustworthy. But what we don't all know is who those certificate authorities are. There's no single list of all of the entities that your browser will trust to sign a certificate vouching for the identity of a website you're connecting to. The reason for this is that those root certificate authorities that are listed in your browser have the ability to delegate their authority to other parties, to what are called intermediate certificate authorities. And those intermediate certificate authorities aren't on any list anywhere. You don't know about them until you see a certificate from them. So what we did was we used ZMAP to crawl the whole public address space, find out what certificate chains it saw, and compile a list of all of those intermediate certificate authorities. We compiled a lot of information about the way those servers were connected too. So this is an example of how you might chain ZMAP together with other kinds of connection and processing libraries in order to do a more sophisticated kind of scan like this. In the end, we did about 200 internet-wide probes to get this data. More than internet-wide scans, each of them more comprehensive than the EFF SSL Observatory, more than a trillion probe packets sent over the course of a bit more than a year. So in addition to finding, I think, 1,300 entities that can sign a certificate for any website you visit, because there's no kind of limitation to that scope of authority and trust that's put into SSL certificate authorities, we find interesting things like this. There are still 50% of certificates are eventually rooted in a 1024-bit key. This is something on the verge of being factorable. More than 70% of these roots will expire more than 2 years from now. So this is bad. On the other hand, there's some good things. During the life of this scan, we see TLS deployment growing dramatically. We see a 10% uptick in the number of servers, a 23% uptick among Alexa top 1 million. We need to encrypt the web. Progress is happening. I hope it will happen more quickly. All right, so just a couple of concluding remarks. One of my goals from all of this is to encourage everyone here to be doing more work involving internet-wide scanning, involving measurement, involving trying to understand the internet from this perspective of global measurement. And we've shown with work like the weak key work that this can give you really new and different kinds of security insight. In order to try to make this possible, since not everyone has bandwidth to do these scans themselves, we're taking the data that we collect in our scans and throwing it up on the web, and we'd be happy to host data from other people too. We're getting data from Rapid7 now already. So if you go to scans.io, you can download the data sets, do your own data mining on them yourselves, and ask probing questions. ZMapp is also available online. You can get it here. Our demo is not actually running, but I'll run it soon. Finally, if you do decide to do scanning yourself, just a few reminders about ethics. So it is possible to cause damage by overwhelming other people's networks. And we don't want to be DOSing people. We want to be measuring what's publicly visible. But there's no way to request permission from everyone involved, because there's no equivalent to robots.txt for IP. So for now, in order to avoid alarming administrators, in order to avoid knocking networks offline inadvertently, there are a bunch of steps you can take to try to reduce impact. One, just using the random ordering that things like ZMapp provide should help with avoiding DOSing people. It's also a good idea to try to signal that you're not maliciously, you don't have malicious intent. We do things like put up a web page on port 80 on the scan source IP addresses to let people know. And of course, honor requests to be removed. So the bottom line is, be a good neighbor, don't be a jerk, and everyone can get along. So over 200 internet-wide scans, we only got about 145 requests from people who wanted to be blocked from further scanning. Certainly some people blocked us without requesting, but very little. Just one more story. One thing went wrong, which is that at one point during our scanning, this article appeared in a certain publication linked to from the Drudge Report, about how Iranian attackers had taken over a large part or all of the University of Michigan College of Engineering web, network in order to attack US banks. There were several things wrong with this story. It wasn't Iranian hackers, it was Zakir, my student. So we got them to run a little bit of a statement from us saying, no, this isn't accurate, but they say their expert stands behind their assertion that this was Iranian attackers. All right, so there's much more to be done, but I hope everyone will use this technique to do great research. We're living really in a golden age now. Networks and computers are fast enough to exhaustively scan IPv4, and IPv6, which has a much larger address space that's going to be hard to scan, isn't here yet. So this is an opportunity for all of us who are interested in what's on the internet to go ahead and find out. So again, here are some URLs for things you can try out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex. Certainly a very interesting talk. Now, we've got time for about one or two questions maximum, because we're close to wrapping the session up. So if there's any questions, please just quickly line up behind one of those 8 microphones. Okay, I've got 3 questions, and then I think we'll have to finish up. So go ahead at number 4, please.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. What kind of hardware do you need for the scans? You mentioned a 1 gig uplink pipe, but the server doing the scanning, what do you need?
So for most of these experiments, we used either, I think, about a 5-year-old Dell workstation or a really cheap $800 HP OneU. So low-end but solid-grade hardware, I think, is probably the ideal. You can do pretty well just from cheap commodity stuff.
Okay, thanks.
All right, and number 8, please.
Yes. Thanks that you mentioned IPv6 at the end. I was about to ask about that. The other point, are you aware of the RIPE Atlas project concerning scanning the whole internet in a distributed way?
So I have heard of, but I'm not well versed in that project, and I'd love to know more if anyone involved in it is here. As far as IPv6, IPv6 raises a bunch of interesting new challenges. Of course, the address space is much too big to exhaustively enumerate. My hypothesis is that the main way that we'll scan that is based on lists of addresses that are in use that are collected through passive measurement, probably by people in industry.
Okay, and one question from the internet, please.
How do you think that sysadmins should be dealing with false counts in the future? Do you think it's really worthwhile to send abuse emails and phone calls for each and every false count?
I think sysadmins have to, well, it's difficult for sysadmins. Sysadmins, I think, should recognize that not all probe traffic they're receiving is malicious, and that if it's malicious, people aren't going to stop it just because you ask them to. If it's malicious, the bad actors are probably just going to be probing you from somewhere else. They're probably probing you from a botnet. So I think the gains from spending time trying to stop probe traffic are relatively small compared to what my advice to sysadmins would be, which is to make sure you're scanning your network yourself and locking it down. So that there isn't anything that a bad actor can gain by getting visibility into what's publicly addressable in your network.
Okay, and the very last question, because we're running out of time, for microphone number one, please.
Hi, thanks, sir. Yeah, just going back to that thing about the when you use the time of day to explain the difference in responses. Were you using? Does that mean that that scan sample you used in that test was based in the same time zone, or how do you explain that? Do you see? I didn't quite get that because it shouldn't be explainable that way.
So no, we picked a random sample of IP addresses, about a million addresses in those tests, and just probed them every few minutes throughout a day. And what we're seeing, is that there are actually fewer responsive hosts at certain times of day. So there are reasons you might expect that to happen, that if some of these devices are things that people are powering off at home while they're asleep, they're things at offices that are going to into hibernation mode, their phones. So I think it's a reflection of just the aggregate diurnal pattern of everyone who's plugged into the address space. I'd be happy to talk about it more, but that's the working hypothesis, because we can't actually find any difference in, it's not at all correlated with any local variation, with the cycle of local variation in network traffic. In fact, we're seeing more responsive stuff at times when we'd expect our network to be more heavily loaded.
Okay, before we're wrapping up, I would like to remind everyone to please provide us with some feedback, because that helps the speakers improve their presentations, and it also helps the whole Congress. So if you want to do that, you hop online at the FARPLAN. There is some feedback forms. It would be really great if you could fill them out. Last thing, don't forget to collect your rubbish. It would be really great if you take it out. And we do recycle the bottles, so there should be crates outside to put them in. And last thing, one more round of applause for Alex. Thank you very much.